The following audio is from Park Church in Denver, Colorado. More information about Park Church is available online at parkchurchdenver.org.
My name is Joel, by the way. I'm on staff here at Park. Thank you to all of you for coming out. And thanks to Jamie Smith for speaking. That was awesome. I met Mike Cosper a few years ago. And he's at Sojourn Church out in Louisville, Kentucky. And just from the beginning, he's had a great impact in my life, both him and what God's doing at Sojourn. And so both through his book, Rhythms of Grace, his latest book, The Stories We Tell, he's just been a helpful influence as God shapes me as a worship leader. And so a quick random story. They do a lot of their own music, and it was I had listened to it, and it's incredibly creative. And a lot of stuff I would listen to, I'm like, I don't know how this would translate in a congregational setting. I just can't see it. I don't know. And it was funny because I got to spend a few days out with them and just kind of see what they do and how they do it. And it was so cool to watch this community in Louisville, songs that I didn't think would connect with congregations, like these little falsetto parts that they would do on there. And all of a sudden, like right after baptism, seeing this whole congregation going, woo, 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 like all singing it together. I'm like, all right, so it works, you know. But it's just a vibrant community in the heart of Louisville. And I think a large part is God is using, Mike and the way he's geared him and kind of written his DNA into him. And so, Mike, if you want to just come up here and kind of just share a little more, a lot of stuff is going to be more practical stuff, about Sundays and liturgies. And so, why don't we just welcome Mike?
Hey, thanks for having me here. I said to Joel right before, like, you're really going to make me follow James K. Smith? But what I've got for you, I think there's a sheet that I think they've passed out. If you don't have it, I think there may be more to come around. But it's just 10 questions that we think through, and we kind of visit these fairly regularly at Sojourn when we're thinking about planning worship and we're evaluating our services and what we've been doing. A little background on the church. We're a church of four campuses, so it's almost like a parish model. And each campus has a worship pastor that oversees the music and liturgy at the campus. And we all kind of collaborate together. So it's a very collaborative environment in terms of how we plan and what we do for Sundays. And so I'm going to kind of try to power through this and leave some room for questions. And if you have specific questions about liturgy or what we do, I'd be glad to get into some of that. But let's start with sort of this broad stuff. The first three are what I call the context questions. These are the questions we need to ask about how we serve the people who show up. And the first one is simply, who is here? And I think that this is a really crucial question for young pastors, for church planters, for pastors. Maybe if you're in a situation with your congregation where there's conflict in terms of worship style or what's going on in the life of the church. Oftentimes, it's easy to get kind of an ideal set in our head of like, I have a vision for my church, and I want it to look like this, and I want worship to sound like this, and I want the music to be like this, and I want to create this sort of creative vibe or whatever it may be. But then you show up on Sundays, and it doesn't look anything like that, and it can you can very easily grow really discontent with your congregation, with your worship leaders, with your volunteers, with all of this, because you have this beautiful image of your head of what a church should look like. And it's probably built off of, you know, it's probably a composite of experiences you've had, especially if you're a church planter. You know, when you have that blank slate, you have a picture in your mind of what it's supposed to look like. And very rarely does the reality of what turns up in your congregation match that picture. And so I think the first thing that we're responsible for is to love the people who are here. Love the people who are showing up. Understand who they are. Understand what they're about. And love them by creating a worship culture that speaks the language that they speak, whether that's aesthetically or culturally or whatever. A great example of this was I had a friend who was planting a church in an urban context, and he brought me in to kind of talk with his worship leaders. And this was a crew of maybe half a dozen guys, all white guys, all who grew up middle class and upper middle class in the suburbs, and they'd all moved into a neighborhood that was sort of mixed race, mixed socioeconomic status, and they'd been going for about a year, and they couldn't understand why they weren't attracting African Americans. And And as we started to talk about it, there was this, again, there was this incredible discontent about, well, we're trying to reach these people. Our people don't like the music that we're playing, but we're playing this music because we're trying to make space and be hospitable to African Americans. And I was like, well, what kind of music are they playing? And so these are, again, white guys from the suburbs trying to play black gospel. And in the process, they're making everybody mad, right? Because it's not that they're doing a great job. They're playing it badly. And so the church that's there feels like, why does music suck every Sunday? And then visitors, if they can, could attract African-Americans into their church, the visitors that would come in were like, well, this is just offensive. another example of this was a guy I knew who was planting in the suburbs who his vision for his church looked very sort of West Coast, edgy, indie rock. And he was planting in, you know, in a nice suburban, very white, very upper middle class neighborhood. And he just had all this tension because he wanted this edgy, creative, you know, culture. He wanted to paint the room into a black box and all of this. And nobody in his church wanted to do that. The point being, the people that are showing up on Sunday mornings are the people that God has put there for you to minister to and to love and to equip so that when they come and they gather for worship, they are joyfully being formed and being shaped by the things that you practice. So don't push your culture up against the people who are there. The second question that needs to be asked as well is this question of who needs to be here. And the way I like to think about this is if you're in a neighborhood and you're trying to reach that neighborhood evangelistically, ask yourself, what would it look like if Jesus came to everybody in a dream tonight, and tomorrow morning they all woke up and they were saved, and they spontaneously started to worship? What would that look like? How would they naturally begin to celebrate? How would they naturally begin to worship, not knowing anything at all about what it means to be a Christian or what it means to practice within the church? That's obviously not supposed to be your sole guide, your only guide. But it's a window, it's a thought experiment that I think gives us a window into what does contextualization really mean? How do we speak the heart language, the cultural language of the people we're trying to reach? The third question that I think is really crucial to ask is, who's been here before us? And by that, there's a very literal sense in which you want to honor the history of your congregation. Especially if you're part of a more established congregation, if you've got folks who've been worshiping in this same church for 25, 30 years, you want to honor their presence. You want to know their hymnal. You want to know their traditions and practices, and you want to find ways, how can you sustain that and connect it as the church continues to grow and as worship evolves and changes with the shifts in the congregation. Don't just sing songs that were written in the last decade. If you're going to sing hymns, don't just sing retuned hymns. Connect your church with a sense of history, with a sense that what you're doing on a Sunday morning didn't start with you. It didn't start with this church. And I think that's even more crucial to emphasize when you're church planting, because it does feel like you've got this blank slate. Especially, I mean, in my denomination, it's literally a blank slate. Like, you go through this rigmarole to get approved as a planter, and then they fund you, and after that, you may never hear from them again. You can kind of do whatever you want. Attach yourself to some sense of history and some sense of tradition so that the church recognizes, hey, we're part of something that's much bigger than this expression on a Sunday morning. Some ways you can connect to that tradition: you can do the occasional creed, you can sing some of these older hymns. Again, don't just live and function in such a way that everything looks like it's brand new. And if you notice, between those three ideas, they're all in conflict, right? Love who's here, love who needs to be here, and honor the fact that you're from some, you know, that there's something that came before you. All three of those ideas are in conflict. And so I don't think that this is an equation where you go, okay, now we've figured it out, and we're going to do it this way, and this is going to be able to meet the needs of all three of these audiences or all three of these priorities. I think what you're going to find is that worship is something that shifts throughout the seasons of the life of your church. And so pastorally, you have to be discerning. What are we doing? Where are we at? What's our scorecard right now with serving our congregation well? And where have we erred? Where have we overemphasized in maybe one of these areas over another one? You'll find that that's sort of a dialogue that's going to be ongoing with you and those that are involved in planning worship. All right, the second set of questions, I call them the clarity questions. And the first one is very simply, is it comprehensible? And I think this is a huge one for us in sort of North American evangelicalism. There's a whole body of jargon that gets adopted and that gets used in church. You hear it in the way that people, you know, you get a bunch of Christians to get on microphones and start praying together, and you'll hear this sort of string of jargon. It's so good to be fellowshipping with you today, church. I'm excited to begin dialoguing with you about the journey of the heart that we're taking as the Lord sanctifies and mortifies us so we can love on each other. Let's bathe this thing in prayer and ask for a hedge of protection around us, right? So that's, you know, for an outsider, you're speaking a foreign language. It's stock phrase, stock cliche, it's jargon. And if you're in the church long enough, you hear it so much that you begin to just sort of spin this stuff out all the time. And the language becomes kind of meaningless. You're functioning without actually being engaged at the level of the imagination or the heart, because there's nothing challenging about jargon. It doesn't mean anything. You know, you've heard it so many times, you can buzz through it. You could all probably do your own versions of that. To an insider, the danger remains because you've created a subset of language for this little corner of our lives that happens for an hour to an hour and a half on Sunday mornings, instead of learning to speak about our faith in the same ways that you would speak about anything else in your life. People often refer to that as Christianese, but I think even referring to it as Christianese is jargon. I would argue that as pastors, we need to care as much about language as we care about theology. Because if we're trying to connect, if we're trying to communicate, if we're trying to break through the preconceptions, the misconceptions, the wrong presuppositions that our congregation has picked up from the culture around them, then we have to be very crafty and very clever in the ways that we get past, again, the sort of the world of cliches and all these ways that we've hardened ourselves to the truth. And I think one of the easiest way to do this is to really think about communicating, whether it's leading in worship or leading in preaching, with the same way you would think about the rules of good writing. Never use two words when one word will do. Never use a big word when a small word will do. Have sympathy for your audience and constantly ask yourself, why should they care about what's happening right now in my sermon or in the service or in this prayer meeting or whatever it is? Read good writing. Read outside of Christian circles and read great writing. Seek out good writing, whether it's fiction or nonfiction or poetry. This essentially expands the available inventory that you have for language, for metaphors, for images, for ideas. I'd argue that this is one of the things that makes Keller such a great preacher, is that he's constantly immersing himself in the world of ideas. He's reading great writing. And his gift for language, that's what makes Keller incredible, is that you listen to his preaching and there's no jargon. He understands that the people that are walking in his door are bombarded with this stuff, and that he's got to find ways to subvert their expectations and use fresh metaphors, fresh language, fresh ideas to communicate the gospel. A study of good writing as well. I want to give you three quick recommendations. The first two are very short reads, and the third one's a longer one. The first one is Politics in the English Language by George Orwell. It's a little article sort of on rhetoric. And it gets at a lot of this stuff. And as you read that article and you think about your preaching, if you're like me, you'll be very convicted by it. Politics and the English Language by George Orwell. The second one is Quack This Way. Quack like a duck. Quack This Way by David Foster Wallace and Brian Garner. That's a transcript of an interview that took place between these two guys. And again, very similar stuff. They're talking about... A lot of that interview, they're talking about technical writing for legal work and other stuff. But it again, the metaphors apply. You'll see how it applies to preaching. And then the other one is William Zinsser's book, On Writing Well. You can actually get that in audiobook form. It gives you exercises and stuff. And again, apply that to preaching. Apply that to thinking through writing liturgy. And you'll be amazed at how convicting it is and how often you do reach for stock phrases and cliches and jargon. The second thing when it comes to clarity is the question, is it worth the cost? So inevitably, in the church, the fact is that there's jargon, there's language that sort of floats around and doesn't mean anything, but there is a unique language of our faith. There is a syntax to Christianity. There are words that you need to learn, and you need to know, and you need to understand what they mean. And so when it comes, you know, when it comes time in the service where you encounter something like that, or when you bring in a historic element that has language or metaphors or ideas that aren't part of sort of everyday speech, you need to sort of count the cost. Is it worth the time that it would take to explain this, to explain the meaning of a theological term, to explain the meaning of an image that's going to be of a metaphor that's in a song? Is it worth the cost of saying, let's make sure that the congregation understands the words that we're going to put in their mouth. To me, one of the primary culprits on this is the Ebenezer verse in "Come Thou Fount of Every Blessing." You guys know the verse. Here I raise my Ebenezer. There you go. You all know the verse. So it's a great example of something where I would argue probably 90% of the people walking through your door have no idea what that phrase means. And yet, it's a great example of one that we're often just putting in front of them because we love the hymn. Like, we're emotionally attached to the hymn. We want to sing the hymn. They want to sing the hymn. They're emotionally attached to it because it's a great hymn. But every time that phrase comes up, you're doing two things. One is that they're either walking away and they're feeling stupid that they don't know what it means, or they're learning to tune out. And if you throw language at people that they have to tune out over and over and over and over and over again, then you're reinforcing that they should be tuning out. They're reinforcing the idea of, let's just let this stuff pass by. I'm not going to understand it anyway. And so whenever you throw a difficult concept, you need to take the time to explain it. And if it's not worth taking the time to explain what an Ebenezer is, just skip the verse. You know, you can save the song, you can skip the verse. That's one example. I'll give a counterexample. There's a John Newton hymn called "Begone Unbelief" that Kevin Twitt and Indelible Grace have retuned, and we sing it at Sojourn quite a bit. And it's got this image, "Though cisterns be broken," and it relies on that image a lot. "Though cisterns be broken and creatures all fail, the word he has spoken will surely prevail." And every time we do that song, literally every time we do that song, we take a moment. It only takes a sentence or two. We take a moment. We'll either read the passage that's referencing, or we'll explain what a cistern is and what that metaphor is supposed to mean. Because to my mind, it's worth taking. Let's just take a few sentences and explain this, because it's a beautiful song, and the whole of that text is just gorgeous. A couple more thoughts on clarity. First off, different congregations can get away with different decisions here. My congregation is a church in the inner city. It's a mix of highly educated professionals and very much lower working class people who are down and out. So literally this last Sunday, I was up helping with leading the liturgy, and I look out, and in the second row is the city's leading endocrinologist, and she educated out the wazoo, worked at the Mayo Clinic, all of this. Two seats away from her is a girl who, at 14 years old, her mom started pimping her out, and she's been working in the sex industry for the last 20 years, and she just got out a month ago, and they're sitting two rows apart. And so one of the challenges when it comes to clarity, one of the challenges is, pastorally, we need to speak from the platform in such a way that she understands, and so does the endocrinologist, right? We need to speak in a way that somebody who's highly educated and walks off the street is edified, and so is somebody who literally probably had a third or fourth grade reading level because she never went back to school after that. The goal is that your language serves all of them. And the truth is that, kind of like the contextualization questions, you'll find that that's not always possible. That sometimes you're going to find yourself sort of throwing a bone to the folks who are interested in heavier concepts and heavier lifting. And at times you're going to be throwing a bone to the folks who are really building from the ground up. It's that idea of that contrast of milk and meat. And you need both. Your congregation really needs both. And you need to give them both in such a way that you're not just throwing stock phrases, cliches at them that they can just sort of buzz past. But you need to be thinking very carefully about language all the way through your services, not just the sermon, but your prayers, your calls to worship, anytime you're communicating with them, thinking carefully about the language. Another thing you want to do with these is you want to teach preference and deference. This is a principle that Chip Stamm used to always talk about. But it's the idea that when I gather with the church, sometimes I'm going to have sort of an aesthetic experience that's what I prefer. I'm going to hear the songs I like. I'm going to hear a preacher who, out of the stable of preachers who may be showing up, he's my favorite preacher, you know, and all of this. But sometimes I'm going to show up, and there's going to be a younger preacher who struggles a little bit more, and I don't quite identify with him. Or there's going to be the worship leader is going to make some aesthetic choices in terms of arrangements or musical style or that kind of thing that just rub me the wrong way. And what Chip says that I think is so helpful is, he says, a mature Christian is easily edified. A mature Christian can show up in a context where they're not getting what they prefer, but they're there to love the body around them. They're love to encourage the body around them. They're there to participate and sing with the body around them, in spite of the fact that their cultural preferences are being pushed up against. One more resource on this front that I think is really helpful when it comes to language in the church is a book by Ron and Deborah Reinstra called Worship Words. And it's from front to back, it's a book about the language and worship and really connecting, understanding spiritual formation through the development of a language, of a way of talking about our faith and connecting it to all of life. All right, the next batch of questions here is the theology questions. And the sixth one is pretty simple, pretty straightforward. Is it true? You obviously don't want to be intentionally communicating things that are not true. And listen, I'll try not to get on a rant about contemporary worship songs here, but every song we choose, no matter how much our church loves it, has to be scrutinized on this front. And a lot of times, one of the things that, as a guy who's written some songs, I know that sometimes when you're writing a song, you're trying to sort of cram ideas and images in just to make the song work. And you see it in CCM a lot, where there's images that are fuzzy, they're murky, they don't quite make sense, they don't quite translate. If you're struggling to understand what a metaphor or what a verse might mean in a contemporary worship song, then your congregation is definitely struggling to understand. So think about the clarity, think about whether or not it's clear. And then again, is it true? And I'll give two examples of sort of classic CCM worship stuff, which is not true. The first one is this song, Our Love is Loud, Dave Crowder. It was a great big hit. But the bridge of that song, Our Love is Big, Our Love is Loud, Fill This Place with This Love Now. It couldn't possibly be more, the whole song, if you really, it couldn't possibly be more man-centered. Like, hey, God, check out what we're doing. It's really great. Our love is big. Our love is loud. Like, check this out. That's the whole sort of theme of the song. And it's wrong-headed, because that's not what worship is about. I love what Jamie said at the end of his talk there, where he said that fundamentally what worship is it's something that God is doing that we are participating in. And there's so much of what's happening with contemporary worship that's about, look how great what we're doing is. Look what a party we're having, because God is awesome. And it's just wrong-headed. And it communicates the wrong thing to your people, because actually, again, just think of it in terms of formation. Okay, I'm going to sing this song 12 times over the next year. What am I going to walk away with? I'm going to walk away with the idea that when I show up at church, I'm there to perform for God. I'm there to put on a show that impresses him. The second one is Paul Baloche's song, Above All, right? This one's gotten a lot of beatings in the blogosphere. I won't belabor it. But the line, you took the fall and thought of me above all. Again, it just misses the glory of God. The obedience of the Son to the Father is just completely absent in the whole song. And I think, it's this man-centered kind of thing. And sometimes it's tempting to go, well, it's just the one song and the church really loves it, and we'll slip it in. And you slip it in 8 or 10 times a year. And you're forming your people to think that way about themselves in their relationship with God. All right, moving on before I get into the rant. The second one, number seven, is who's the hero? Who's the hero of the worship service? Every worship service tells a story. Every worship service has a kind of emotional arc, a dialectical flow, a conversation that's happening that leads to the service's conclusion. And I would argue that often in North American evangelicalism, that flow is built around the sermon and the preacher in such a way that it galvanizes the preacher as the hero of the service. You know, hearing phrases like, I can't wait to hear from the Lord this morning actually often means, I can't wait to hear the sermon this morning. And those are connected as meaning the exact same thing. I don't mean to offend on this point, but I think one of the ways that this has been galvanized even further is image magnification during the service. And if you do that, I'm sorry, we can talk afterwards and I'll totally apologize. But if you think about it, image magnification is one of the ways that this gets subtly reinforced. Instead of being in a large room with a human being who's in a normal perspective at a pulpit or on the platform, who's swallowed up by a large room or a large stage like the rest of us, we're looking at a larger-than-life version of that guy projected way above our heads. And that's an experience that we're used to seeing, right? And some people would say, well, it's just sort of a cultural thing. We're used to seeing that. We see that all the time. We see it at concerts. We see it at political rallies. We see it at sporting events. And we don't think much of it when we see it there. It's just a way to kind of see faces and get in closer. But again, think about those events. Who's shown on the screen at those events? You're seeing Kevin Durant. You're seeing Bono. You're seeing Barack Obama. And the reason that you're trying to get into the face of those people is that they're being projected as heroes. You want to see the heroes. You want to see the stars. You want to see those people up close and personal, larger than life. And I think that technology has a way, and I don't want to get too sidetracked with it, but I think that technology has a way of communicating way more than we think it does, and forming people's expectations way more than we think it does when we put that before people. Much of what we think of as contemporary and casual worship culture is just been stuff that we've transported in. I think you said exactly this. Just stuff that we've transported in from sort of celebrity culture at large. There's a reason that all of the historical liturgies, almost all of them, placed communion at the center and treated reading God's word as something sacred, made a big deal when you make a big deal when you read the scriptures. If you get nothing else out of this, hear this. Make a big deal out of reading the Bible. Make people see the Bible, show it to them, read it to them, and then tell them what you just did. This is the word of the Lord. Because what's that doing? The reason you say that every week and you say it over and over and over again is because you want people to understand that there's a difference between when I'm talking and when I'm reading this thing. There's a great section in, or a great little story in Worship Words where he talks about exactly this, like making a big deal out of reading scriptures and why you have these liturgical moments in the service where you say things like, in this one church in particular, every week the pastor would read the scriptures and he would end by saying, the grass withers and the flowers fade, but the word of the Lord stands forever. And one week after church, this kid comes up to the pastor and he says, hey, pastor, why is it that every single week after we read the scriptures, you say the grass withers and the flowers fade, but the word of the Lord stands forever? He goes, so that you would remember it. Right? Because you just proved why I do it. You just proved it because you remembered it. You heard it. I would just go a little further here and say, I think that when we gather as the church, what you want to put before people are the things that wherever they go for their church for the rest of their lives, they're remembering are the main things, are the most important things. The Word of God, the Lord's table, the baptismal. The things, the symbols, and the sources of all of our practices. Put those things in prominent places. Make a big deal about doing them. I'll never forget being at a church a couple of years ago, and it was just mildly disturbing because we were in the middle of a worship service, and it was a contemporary church, contemporary service, big auditorium, and I just remember they were sitting there, and a guy singing a solo. And they've done nothing else, but he's like halfway through the solo, and all of a sudden somebody taps me on the shoulder, and I look over, and he's handing me a communion plate. And they'd said nothing to introduce communion. Like, I had no idea it was coming, and it was so jarring to me to think, like, this is being sort of done almost like under the table. Like, yeah, well, this guy's singing, we're just going to go ahead and get this out of the way, and then get on with our services. So if you hear anything else, who's the hero of your service means put God before them as clearly as possible. When you read his word, make sure that you're differentiating between your words and his words. Put the symbols he has given us and said, do these things in remembrance of me. Put those in prominent places and make sure that it's very clear that's what you're doing when you do them. Okay. Finally, the pastoral questions. I suppose you could argue that they're all pastoral questions, but I didn't have another category to call these. So, number 8, is it participatory? Very simply, if the church isn't singing, praying, and involved actively the majority of the time, we're probably doing it wrong. The worship services are the work of the people. It's ground zero for spiritual formation. And the things you have them say and do during the service will stick with them throughout their weeks in ways that you and I can't quite comprehend. The way that songs stick with people, the way that the scriptures stick with people, the way that the scriptures are read in a service and then encountered again in ordinary life in ways that are life-giving. I think this is one of the reasons why the English Reformation was so invested in writing hymns. They understood that hymns were kind of a portable theology. They stuck in your minds. The rhyme schemes were easily remembered, a memorable way to teach people to think about God and to pray. On this front, think about this. Take a practices inventory with your congregation. And what I mean by this is, for 1 month, keep track of everything you do in your gathering, everything you do in your service. What have you prayed? What songs have you sang? What ways have people been active in the service? How much time in the service has the church been passive? How much time have they spent sitting and passively receiving? And I'm not anti-preaching at all. I'm not anti special music, for lack of a better term. But I think we need to think about what is that, and how actively involved is the church in what we're doing on a Sunday morning. So take that inventory and check it, and talk about it, but also look at it up against the historic liturgies that we've been talking about, whether it's Cranmer's liturgy or any of the others, and look at how involved the congregation is there. And just ask yourself, like, how does this stack up? How does it compare in terms of involvement? Another thought on this, I should have brought it, but D.A. Carson's chapter in Worship by the Book has a really extensive list of all the things that the church is called to do, all of the practices they're called to do, greeting one another with a holy kiss, singing, you know, the whole nine yards. It's a long list. So do this practices inventory and get that book. It's worth getting. It's a great book. And compare your practices to the list that Carson has. And just ask yourself, what are we doing? What are we not doing? And why aren't we doing the things that we're not doing? And have some conversations about that pastorally. I think too much of our North American evangelical experience thinks of worship services as basically being about songs and sermons, with the former basically being a prelude to the latter. And to go back to the hero idea, I think, again, what that does is it sets up this thing where it sort of reinforces this idea of, like, okay, we're going to get hyped up, and then he's going to come and he's going to tell us what God wants us to know. And there's a measure of truth, right? Like, we do proclaim the word of God when we preach. But that's not the only thing that's supposed to be happening when the church gathers. That the other practices are massively important when it comes to the spiritual formation of the church. Some of you may have to begin thinking through, how much time do we give to this stuff? How much time do we give to worship? I remember visiting a church one time where they'd asked me to preach. And I normally preach anywhere from 30 to 40 minutes, depending on how long-winded I get and distracted. But I was getting ready to get up to preach, and I just kind of... I leaned over to the guy and I said, oh, how long did you normally go? And he goes, oh, I go about an hour and 10 minutes. And I started laughing, and I said, how many songs do you guys do on a Sunday? He said, oh, we do two songs and we do like a pastoral prayer. And then it's an hour and 10 minutes. And I just think about what that communicates to the congregation. Why are we gathering? We're gathering to hear this guy talk for an hour and 10 minutes. One other note on this front, I'm totally a contemporary music guy. I'm an electric guitar player. I play loud tube amps. So those are my bona fides. But too often I see worship services that just simply don't make space for people's voices. That doesn't mean that you have to strip it down to a piano and organ. It also doesn't mean that the service can't get a little loud sometimes. In fact, frankly, I think loudness in contemporary worship is a cultural necessity. At times, look at how we celebrate as a culture. Why does the Super Bowl have a halftime show with a rock and roll show in the middle of it? That's how we celebrate. But that's not the only thing we should be doing when the church gathers. We shouldn't just be loud and celebrative. So you've got to find ways to make space for people's voices. There's ways to have a rock band on the stage and to teach the rock band that they don't have to play every note of every song beginning to end, that they can sit out in verses, that you can make space, you can end songs a cappella, you can have, you know, in four or five songs in a service, you can have half of them that are much more simple and make space for people to sing. The other side of this that's really true is that traditional classical worship expressions were often pretty darn loud. I was in a worship service one time where it was just a pipe organ, and it was ear-splitting. I have a decibel meter on my phone, and it was like 110 dB all the way through, right? Like, I'd get fired if I did that at Sojourn, you know? Okay, again, worship leaders should be discerning about what gets loud and when, and throughout the service, the emphasis should be on the congregation's ability to sing along. Kevin Twitt swears he didn't say this, but I promise you he did. He said arrangements should invite us to participate, not invade our space. And I'm going to attribute that to Twitt, even though he says he didn't do it. All right, number nine, does it speak to rich and poor alike? We covered this a little bit before, but how would a poor person feel when they come to your church? And I think this really comes back again to this idea of clarity, of simplicity of language. The fact that somebody who walks in your church, if you're speaking at a high intellectual level, if you're covering a lot of theology, a lot of content during your services, the fact that somebody can keep up with that is frankly a sign of privilege. It's a sign that they've had an educational experience that's afforded them the ability to hang in there with you. And oftentimes, when you have poor people who walk in off the streets, if they're in your congregations, they haven't had that privilege, and you're leaving them behind. So love the poor people in your congregations by finding ways to speak more simply, to speak more clearly, to speak more plainly. There's a church that I totally love whose services are almost identical to the services of like a classic 17th century Baptist, particular Baptist church. They're theologically rich, they're historic, and it's great. But if you look at who's in that congregation, they're all highly educated professionals. And again, some of that's context. Some of that's the neighborhood that the church is in, and I get it. But again, I want you to think about your church and your congregation. Are there poor people that you're excluding because you're speaking at a level that they can't understand, that they haven't had the opportunity to learn and grow and understand with you? And I think another way to love the poor is to acknowledge injustice in the world, to acknowledge social injustices, and to be praying for justice as a church together. And then finally, to acknowledge suffering, and that really gets me to the last point, number 10, which is, does worship prepare people for their encounters with death? My friend, I've already mentioned, this is my third mention for Kevin Twitt today. Kevin he runs Indelible Grace, which is a ministry out of Nashville that works with songwriters, and they do retuned arrangements of old hymns. And one time there was the GMA annual meeting. He was asked to be on a panel of songwriters, and it was him and a bunch of Christian contemporary worship musicians and songwriters. And somebody asked the question, what makes a great worship song? And they kind of went down the line, and it was like, you know, it has to have a great chorus, you know, an anthemic chorus. It has to have this, it has to have that. And they get to Kevin, and if you know Kevin, you can just see the grin on his face as he said this. He goes, I think it should prepare people to die. And what he means that worship, ultimately, worship is an encounter that should be preparing us for death. There's a great chapter in a book by John Whitfield on just this. Worship should prepare us for our encounters with death, because it should make us prepared for suffering. It should make us prepared for loss. It should make us prepared for hardship. It should make us prepared for visits to the hospital and visits to the graveside, because inevitably those things come in our lives. We can't avoid them. A story that I thought was fascinating, Harold Best once recounted there was this incredible shift in CCLI reporting after 9/11. Because in the wake of 9/11, in the wake of sort of national tragedy and all that came afterwards, people couldn't sing contemporary worship songs on Sunday mornings anymore. They couldn't just sing that stuff. They had to go back to the hymnal. They had to go back to places where people talked about suffering and they talked about loss. Too often our services, our worship service, get into this sort of triumphalistic modes of rightly celebrating the glory of God, of rightly celebrating the joy of being the church, but to the exclusion of the fact that there are people who are walking through your doors who are suffering, whose family members are suffering. Somebody who walks through your door who has cancer. I can think of a girl in my congregation right now. She's 28 years old. She has a 9-month-old baby, and 4 weeks ago she wasn't feeling good. She went to the doctor, and about 72 hours later, they diagnosed her with stage 4 colon cancer. It's metastasized. It's all through her body. And her prognosis isn't good. And there are people like that who are showing up and sitting in your congregation every single week, you know, who are getting that diagnosis or whose parents are getting that diagnosis. And so look at your worship services. Again, if you do that practices inventory, this is a great question to ask. Look at your worship services and ask yourself, somebody who came in that was really suffering, how did we speak to them? How did we speak to their longing? How did we speak to their fear? How did we speak to their anger, to their frustrations with the way that the world is? Have we provided any space for that whatsoever? Because ultimately, I think that's one of those key things where you do it faithfully, and the ways that you've equipped people in your congregations will show up in their lives when it's ready. We sing a song at Sojourn that's it's a retuned Isaac Watts hymn called "Absent from Flesh," and one of my best friends, this was 10 years ago, his mother passed away. She'd been really sick and in the hospital for a few months, and then she'd gotten home and she'd kind of gotten better, and then one night she just took a turn for the worse, and it was kind of like out of nowhere she passed away overnight. And we, me and our friends, my friend sent a group of us this text, and it said, my mother left her failing body tonight. My mother left behind her failing body tonight. And I immediately recognized that that was a line from this hymn. And I got to talk to him about it afterwards, and he said, you know, it was crazy how much I thought of that song all night long, over and over and over again, that my mom's absent from us, but she's present to the Lord. And I had the comfort of that because we'd sung that song over and over and over again. So ask yourself, in what ways are you preparing your congregation for hospitals and gravesites? And preparing, ultimately preparing them to be able to speak the gospel to themselves and to one another when those moments come. So I'll hit the brakes there. I think we still have some, do we still have time for questions? Yeah, great. Questions? Who's going to be bold, go first? Oh, there we go. Mm-hmm. Yeah, we so deliberately our growth seasons every year tend to be September and January, and that's when we tend to just attract a lot of new people to the church. And so during those 4 week windows every year, we deliberately really simplify what we do liturgically and explain everything. So the pastor will say, hey, we open our services with a call to worship. What that means is that we allow the scriptures to invite us to respond to who God is and what he's done. This is something that we do every week, you know. And all the way through, you know, the prayer of confession is treated the same way. It's we get to that moment, we say, you know, every week when we celebrate how holy God is or how beautiful God is, we can't help but recognize how we're not adequate to the task of worshiping him. And so we pray every week, we acknowledge together our faults. Sometimes we do it in sort of big picture ways throughout it, like we'll open the service and we'll say, hey, what you'll notice during the service today is that we're telling a story. And the story begins with recognizing that God's holy. When we see God's holiness, we can't help but remember that we're sinners, but Jesus saves us and Jesus sends us. So over the next hour, we're going to tell that story and we're going to practice that story as we sing and pray. The other way that we do it is during our membership classes. So our membership classes literally has like a sample worship service that we walk through and say, hey, this is a typical worship service at Sojourn. Here are the things we do and here's why we do it this way. And so if you're a member, hopefully, I mean, people obviously have ways of getting around membership classes, but if you're a member, you've walked through that, and then a couple of times a year we're kind of doing these little refreshers in seasons. I find that if you just do it once, it doesn't stick, but if you do it for a month at a time, people get it. And we actually, the other way we've done it, we actually just recently did it was an idea one of our pastors had. We did a marriage retreat where the whole retreat was built around the liturgy, and so we talked about sort of applying. Because one of the things I think is so important about the liturgy is that it's a microcosm of the Christian life, right? And so God's word is calling us to worship with all of life. And so we really sort of tried to apply that to marriage. Like, what does it mean to have a home that's acknowledging the glory of God and responding together? What does it mean to confess our sins together in a marriage? So it was all tied in worship. It was a cool experience. Yes.
How do you intentionally encourage togetherness and unity in
That's a good question. The question was, how do you cultivate unity in your practice of the liturgy and the sacraments? Is that right? I mean, I think some of it is more caught than taught, frankly, in that there's definitely a pastoral emphasis on we want you to participate. We want you to include your voice as we read God's word together, as we do these things. And I think that's subversively there, you know, as you're singing together, that's a unity building thing. As you're reading the words together and or reciting a creed together or whatever it may be. I think one of the things we've done intentionally is that when we serve communion, we all serve, everything comes from one table. And so it comes from one table and it goes out into the room because we couldn't all just go to one table. It's too many people. But we make a big deal, like we make a scene of the servers going to one table and then dispersing throughout the room because there is that sense of it being a shared meal. But yeah, I think generally it's more caught than taught. There are liturgical practices that we do. Passing the peace is a big one, and sometimes that just sort of floats by, and you just do it, and it's fairly rote. But then sometimes you really call attention to it, and we've had services at times where we've said, "Hey, today we're going to take about 10 minutes to do this, and we really want you to extend the peace in the sense of get to know some new people, recognize that we're a family here, and let's acknowledge one another and all that." So. Yeah.
Participatory.
Mm-hmm.
Because like when we were there, like everybody kind of participated.
Yeah, so the way we have baptism services about every 6 or 8 weeks, and at a baptism service, the folks who are getting baptized stand on the stage and they're robed in white, and someone reads their testimony. We have them write like a one-page short testimony. So everyone who gets baptized reads their story, gets read before the church. And if it happens to be a service where, like, we've done baptisms that day at earlier services, but no one's getting baptized in that particular service, then we'll put their pictures up and read a testimony or two. And then when they baptize, they get into the baptismal, and we ask everyone to sort of extend their hand as a blessing, as a sign of blessing. And the church all says together, you know, the pastor says, "I baptize you now in the name of," and the church together says, "In the name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit." It's a big celebration. We make a big scene out of it. It's fun. More questions? Yeah.
What about the other end of that spectrum being what's the role of silence?
Yeah.
A lot of times it feels like it's almost many services are all urgent to silence.
Mm-hmm.
Time, yeah.
Right. Yeah. Well, even, I mean, if you look at music historically too, church music was often designed to have extended instrumental moments that allowed for that reflection. That gave people a little bit of space from what was being said or sung. I think that's one of those things that's like when you do your practice inventory, that's definitely one of the things to look out for. Like, is there any space for reflection in the service, or is it just go, 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 go? Because I think that's the tendency. I think it's the gravity. The gravity is to have your service be really frenetic. And was it Saved where the guy does the backflip up off the stage? That's what I always, that's what I always think of. So. Yeah. No, we do child care for 0 to 10 years old. 10 years old and up, they're in the services. Yeah. you break their heart. Yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah. So you've got the guy who isn't talented, and you've got the guy who's way over the top and performing. Being a pastor of musicians means having a lot of hard conversations, and sometimes having the same hard conversation over and over and over again. I've got a musician that works with us that is just a tremendously talented singer, but has a propensity, like, he can do the Chris Cornell, like, take it up the octave, and it's just blow your head off. I mean, it's incredible. It's an incredible skill that really probably has no business in a worship service, right? And so you have to develop sort of thick skin and a gentleness and being able to sit down with people on the one hand and say, hey, you use your gifts to wash people's feet. This is your time to serve. It's not your time to shine. That's one of the little catchphrases that I think is helpful. And then on the other end of the spectrum, being able to say to somebody, hey, I know you're passionate about this, but I think God has gifted you in other ways that would better serve the congregation than in music. And I'm glad you're passionate about this. I'm glad you can enjoy this. Sometimes with folks like that, we try to find other ways that they can help with the music, whether it's, you know, helping with PowerPoint slides or helping with administration stuff behind the scenes or sound and video and stuff like that. Our video is just lyric projection, but yeah, it's just having a lot of hard conversations over and over. One of the things, I mean, on that front, just real quick, if you formalize an audition process so that everybody has to go through the same steps to participate on your worship team, that's one of the ways that you create a kind of a layer of protection for yourself, where you're not asking somebody to jump through hoops that are different than, you know, somebody else who walked in off the street. So, yeah, you're yeah. So we're Baptists. So we definitely, you know, I mean, in terms of the theological spectrum, we're definitely, we could check off all the boxes on the charismatic side. Functionally, you know, it's something that we've explored. We've like prayed and we've had services where we've sort of tried to sort of make space for that and all that. And it's been, it just hasn't taken root. That kind of cultural expression that I think you're talking about hasn't really taken root for us as much as the more sort of planned, you know. I think it's Marva Dawn who says, you know, the Spirit can move on Tuesday morning in planning work for worship as well as he can in the moment on Sunday morning. So I don't know if that's a cop-out, but that's probably the strategy that we employ. Yeah, go ahead.
Do you see any gaps in hymnody that you think the church needs to be, today's church needs to be focused on writing that?
I think for certain, I don't think we have enough songs of lament. I don't think we have enough songs that are as confessional as the Psalms are. Honestly, what's interesting about the hymns is that the hymns struggled with, historically, the hymns struggled with this too. People would write them, but they didn't get sung. We're allergic to that stuff oftentimes. So, I mean, there's some amazing historical texts. There's a handful of them that got used a lot. But I think that that's still the gap, because I really feel pastorally that's such a priority, because those are the things, you know, if we do Dear Refuge of My Weary Soul on a Sunday morning, the Ann Steele hymn that Kevin Twitt, again, retuned. If we do that on a Sunday morning, I know for certain that on Monday morning I'll have 3 or 4 emails from people in the church that hymn really spoke to them. I mean, the text, if you're not familiar with that hymn, check it out, because the text is incredible. She says, Dear refuge of my weary soul, on thee when sorrows rise, on thee when waves of trouble roll, my fainting hopes rely. And then the next line is, but oh, when gloomy doubts prevail. You know? Like, do we sing that as a church? Like, when has your church had the opportunity to sing, oh, when gloomy doubts prevail? I dare to call thee mine. It rips my heart out. I just think about this girl who's dealing with cancer right now. And we sang that song on Ash Wednesday, and you know, that's her journey right now. You know, are we making space in our gatherings where she can say those words with her church, with one voice to her Lord? and then hear the comfort of the gospel in response. I think it's so huge. So, yeah. I think you start by really listening to your congregation, listening to the people that are there, and getting a sense for where are they at in sort of the preference deference spectrum. It's difficult, man. I mean, as one of the things I can really identify with is that you want to open yourself up to feedback, but when the worship leader opens himself up to feedback, it can be a really painful experience. Because very rarely, it takes a very specific personality to send an email to the pastor and tell him what he didn't like about his sermon. It takes a very specific personality to do that on a consistent basis. But everybody who walks in the door of a church on Sunday morning has strong opinions about music and about what we should be singing and shouldn't be singing. So it's tricky because you want to listen, but you don't want to create a culture of critique, which can very quickly happen when you start conversations around this stuff. You can create this, you know, oh, it's my turn to tell you what I don't like? Well, buckle up, buddy. So I think there's some of that. I think if you have friends that are unbelievers, you can. I have a guy who comes to our church. He's come off and on for 15 years. And whenever he comes, I just always ask him what he thinks. You know, what do you think about the music? What do you think about what we do? Do you understand what's going on? What's weird to you? And, Keller has a great line about contextualization. He says that the purpose of contextualizing the gospel is so that the offense of the gospel is clear. I think that's a great litmus test. Like, a lot of times when we think about contextualization, we think, like, I want this to be palatable. I want people to like this. I want it to sound cool and sound like them. And the truth is, what you want is you want to get all the obstacles out of the way, so that you're speaking in a way that they can comprehend. I also say this. I think when it comes to musical style in particular, I think we make way too big a deal out of trying to sort of hit the cultural niche, where excellence really is like a transcendent value that will build bridges. You know. So the metaphor I always use for this is if it's Christmas morning. And you go over to your brother's house, and he's like, hey, little Janie's learning to play the oboe. She's going to play Jingle Bells for us. You know, you all sit around, and little Janie pulls out the oboe. And if you've ever heard anybody learning to play the oboe, it's a horrible experience, right? So she plays Jingle Bells for you, and you all clap and you cheer because you love Janie, right? And you say, if she says, what did you think? You'll say, I thought that was great. Even though in the back of your mind, you were like, that sucked. It was terrible, right? So translate that to the church. In a context with the church where there's a lot of intimacy, if it's a small church and everybody knows one another, then excellence isn't a huge obstacle, because even if the guy on the platform isn't very good at what he does, I know him, I know his wife, I know his kids, I love him, I care about him, and I know that what he's doing comes from a good place, so I'll hang in there with him. On the other hand, if I walk into a giant church of 500 or 600 people, and I don't know anybody, and a guy gets up on the platform, and he's that bad, right? Then not only do I feel awkward, like I feel bad for this guy, I feel awkward, and I just want to get out of there. And so I think excellence is a hospitality issue. And here's the other side of it. If I didn't grow up, in case you can't tell, I didn't grow up going to black gospel churches. I grew up in the suburbs, and a few years ago I started attending just here and there. There's a church in Louisville, St. Stephen's Baptist Church, that has one of the most incredible bands I've ever heard in my life. These guys are just unreal musicians. And so I started going on Saturday nights here and there with some friends just because I wanted to be a part of the community and hear the music, right? And I enjoyed the worship experience and enjoyed the people. And even though I don't know anybody in that place, I feel comfortable and at home because there's something about excellence that draws me in. You know, even though I'm in total fish out of water experience for me. So I think we can make too big of a deal about musical style being the thing that catches people, when really what you want to do is you want to think in terms of hospitality. One needs to be excellent enough that it's not distracting and that people can pay attention without being distracted by it either being too way out stylistically or just a lousy performance. Yeah. Right. Yeah, of course. Yeah, I think if that was what we did every single week all year long, it could get weird, and you could get distracted by it. The vast majority of the time, what we do is we try to translate very. I mean, oftentimes people come and they're surprised at how scripted everything is because it doesn't come off that way. It comes off very conversational. And it's just a pastor who gets up and welcomes and reads the scriptures and that sort of thing. So I think there's a danger of the form becoming the thing that you care more about than anything else. To me, the form fails if it isn't leading you to see the hope of the gospel and the hope of the coming kingdom and send you out in joy with that. So for certain, if that's not happening, then you've got something miscue for sure. Anyone else? We good? All right.